Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I will be reading articles from Smithsonian Magazine here on OWL Radio. Well, this first comes from the July-August 2021 Smithsonian Magazine. Most of them are just a single month, but since it's summertime, they may combine. That may be why they combine 2 months into one. But the first article is actually a letter from the current secretary of the Smithsonian, and it talks about the history of the organization itself. It's called Institutional Knowledge, Precedent, and Promise. And his name is Lonnie G. Bunch III. After a year of absence, returning to my office in the Smithsonian Castle has renewed my wonder at the history that surrounds me and in the growth that nearly two centuries has brought. And as an aside, I have to also mention that they're talking about Smithsonian celebrating its 175th year. Continuing on with Mr. Bunch, I walk past the crypt of James Smithson, who first envisioned this institution. I stroll through the Enid A. Haupt Garden, home to several American bison in the late 1800s. I pass through rooms that held the Smithsonian's earliest collections, 19th century herbarium specimens, and technical apparatuses. I arrive at my office where for decades my predecessors and I have pondered the same question. How can the Smithsonian best serve the American people? This year, the Smithsonian's 175th anniversary offers an opportunity to remember what we've been and appreciate what we've accomplished, and especially after all the nation has been through. It's a chance to assess our impact and imagine what the institution can become. Perhaps nothing speaks to our future like the two new museums on the horizon, the Smithsonian American Women's History Museum and the National Museum of the American Latino. With the successes of the National Museum of African American History and Culture and the National Museum of the American Indian, we learned that telling the American story through different lenses serves all our audiences better, regardless of background or experience. These next museums will help the Smithsonian represent the American experience more fully. By sharing new and powerful stories, they can help all Americans develop a more nuanced, more vibrant understanding of our heritage, our culture, and our national story. This process of creating these museums comes at an opportune moment. The pandemic has challenged the Smithsonian to grow more digitally adept and become more creative, more responsive to audiences' needs. The new museums will post these lessons into action. Models for what museums can and should look like in a post-pandemic world. Having built a museum from the ground up, I know from experience that we have a long way to go. We've named two interim directors and have begun the process of putting together boards and permanent leadership. Still to come, selecting sites, hiring staff, building world-class collections, designing exhibitions, building the museums themselves. The road toward opening will not be easy or quick, but it will be worth it. When these museums open their doors to the public, they will embody the original vision for the Smithsonian as places that enable us all to learn more about ourselves, our country, and our world. So there is still lots to look forward to concerning the growth of the Smithsonian with the planning and first conceptualization and then the actual creating of a new American Women's History Museum and a National Museum of the American Latino. Those are going to be very, very interesting to see. Right now, any visit to Washington, D.C. can allow for many, many days to be spent in all of the different Smithsonian museums. My children particularly like the natural history one because there were some giant prehistoric animals in there. There was a huge mammoth once you went right inside the door. They always made a streak for the mammoth. Well, moving along, the next article is The Past is Prologue and It's Innovation Nation. It was once the Smithsonian's most forward-looking museum. Soon it will be again. Let's see which one of the already existing ones they're talking about. The nation was preparing to celebrate the inauguration of James Garfield in the United States National Museum, today called the Arts and Industries Building. The edifice was not scheduled to debut for several months, so workers moved quickly to install temporary floorboards and thousands of coat racks and hat bins. State flags were hung from above. A statue, America, which resembled the Roman goddess Libertas, was erected in the rotunda beneath the building's dome, her raised torch lit by a new device, Thomas Edison's electric light bulb. On inauguration night, March 4, 1881, guests must have noted how different this building was from other grand museums. The massive exhibition hall in which they toasted the new president was open, with no walls to divide the space. Overhead were skylights, innovative, but perhaps not at their most impressive on this snowy evening. When the original stewards founded the Smithsonian 175 years ago, in 1846, they envisioned it first as a center for scientific research, second as a repository for items representing American arts and sciences. Most contributions were initially stored in what is known as the castle, the institution's first building, erected in 1855. Within a couple of decades, the Smithsonian was bursting at the seams with acquisitions necessitating a kind of house cleaning. Spencer Baird, the institution's second secretary, hired an architect named Adolf Kluss, a German immigrant, to design a new building. It borrowed from Mooresque, Greek, and Byzantine styles. Visitors would be greeted not by imposing marble columns, but by a structure on a human scale made of humble, everyday brick, a material that would also reduce the likelihood of runaway fire, which had devastated the castle and its contents in 1865. To underline the attitude of openness and accessibility, Baird and Kluss created four entrances, each one barely a step up from the street. "You walk in as a citizen of democracy at ground level," says Pamela Henson. A historian with the Smithsonian Libraries and Archives. Text posted on walls and cabinets allowed museum goers to read about objects for themselves, which was a novelty at the time. Baird proved a master of showcasing American scientific and technological advances at the dawn of the Gilded Age. He accomplished one more feat that some regard as a miracle in Washington. He brought the building in on time and under budget. Baird proved a master of showcasing American scientific and technological achievements. George Brown Good, a curator and later the museum's chief administrator, believed the collections should inspire pride in the American spirit. He helped acquire an astonishing number of items, and soon the museum's holdings included 60,000 bird specimens, a Neanderthal skull, George Washington's dress uniform as commander-in-chief, and a 1830s steam locomotive. Imagine case after case after case of objects, or gigantic whale skeletons hanging from the ceiling, says Glenn Adamson, an author and the curator of an exhibition sent to open this November. Just the profusion and the quantitative experience in its early years would have been absolutely mind-blowing. And there was much more to come from across the nation. Live beehives supplied by the Department of Agriculture. The inaugural gown worn by Helen Taft, wife of the 27th president. The Spirit of St. Louis aircraft flown by Charles Lindbergh. A working model of a coal mine complete with moving trains. 6 buffaloes from Montana, a triumph of the taxidermist's art. And a papier-mâché model of a humpback whale sculpted entirely from shredded U.S. currency. Some have called the Arts and Industries Building the incubator for other Smithsonian museums that would spring up over the next 100 years. There's reason to believe that the early exhibitions, with their emphasis on technology and industry, presented the world with a new image of the United States. The novelist Christopher Buckley once wrote that the building's message was, "We're not just a bunch of heavily armed farmers. We know all about this Industrial Revolution thing." For nearly 2 decades, the AIB has been closed for renovation, just repairing the roughly 900 windows, no 2 exactly the same size, proved monumental. But it reopens this fall with an exhibition entitled Futures. It will stretch from a time that items like the telephone were thought to be wildly futuristic dreams to present-day pioneering ideas like bioreactors that cleanse the air and a space sail that will propel travelers through the cosmos. It's an audacious experiment in how to talk about the future, says the museum's director, Rachel Goslins. It can't tell you everything, but it can challenge you to envision it for yourself. The next article is still in this prologue section of the magazine, and it's about transport. This was written by John Sedgwick. Whistle Down the Line. The Golden Spike made the newspapers, but another railroad made an even bigger difference to the nation. When the railroad tycoon Leland Stanford slammed home the fabled Golden Spike at Promontory Point, Utah, in May 1869 to join the Central Pacific to the Union Pacific and complete the country's first transcontinental railroad, the news electrified the country. A single word dispatched by telegram to the newspapers, "Done," set off brass bands and bell ringing across the United States. The new venture, the Pacific Railway, was a heroic achievement, but it was hardly an immediate commercial success, in part because it was never really meant to be. President Abraham Lincoln authorized the undertaking back in 1862, primarily to unite East and West in the hope of making a stronger union once the Civil War was over. Yet on that score, too, it fell short, leaving the job of unifying the country to the second transcontinental, the Santa Fe, started in Kansas in 1863. Whereas the Pacific Railway relied heavily on federal grants, the Santa Fe raised most of its funds privately. It reached the Pacific in 1887 and helped turn the United States into a single economic powerhouse, linking the industrialized East, the Midwestern heartland, and the agricultural glories of the West Coast, all joined in a common market. Still, for some strange reason, the Santa Fe has never received a fraction of the credit that has gone to the Pacific Railway. Created by an act of Congress, the Pacific Railway proved to be the Apollo program of its day, a massive publicly funded project that existed largely to demonstrate an important point. A railroad could indeed make it to San Francisco. This was a remarkable accomplishment, but Congress didn't know what to do with the line once it got there. Promoters paid little attention to building up the freight and passenger traffic needed to succeed financially. Northern congressmen, seeking to retain the benefits of the line for the Union, ensured that it crossed the continent at Chicago's latitude. The placement exposed the tracks to blizzards that would halt trains for weeks and sent them through some of the West's most desolate terrain, well away from the majesty of the Rocky Mountains that might have been attractive to tourists and mining interests alike. In addition, the Pacific initially lacked intersecting feeder lines, which would have contributed valuable passengers and freight. And most of the towns that sprang up along the railway were of the hell-on-wheels variety, notorious for saloons and bordellos that flourished only briefly as town-by-town track laying moved on. The Santa Fe was different. It tried to choose routes that would generate the traffic to cover construction costs, and it selected sites that were likely to grow after the rail arrived. The company acquired open land at low cost and then sold it at a nice markup after the rail line enhanced the land's value. Railroad executives chose the town site, laid out, squared off streets, and often ran their tracks down the middle to create a right side with respectable businesses and a wrong side with the saloons and bordellos. It placed its railroad station in the center of town. Unlike the hell-on-wheels towns, Albuquerque and El Paso were built to last. A corporation in the modern style, the Santa Fe was funded by private investors and run by a professional manager, William Barstow Strong, a veteran railroad man with kindly eyes and an Old Testament beard that ran well down his chest. A big believer in big, he operated by one principle. A railroad, to be successful, must also be a progressive institution, he wrote. By progressive, he did not mean politically. It cannot stand still. If it fails to advance, it must inevitably go backward and lose ground already occupied, was his answer to every business question. And it was his answer his, to every was to lay down track and then lay down some more. The Santa Fe was nonetheless beset by challenges. In the early days, when financing was uncertain, it was slow to lay track across Kansas. When it finally reached Colorado in 1873, the state was still so empty, Denver was the only city of any size, its population roughly 5,000, and much of the terrain still so uncharted, it was hard to know where to place tracks. Worse for the Santa Fe, it came into the state near the tiny trading center of Pueblo, 100 miles south of Denver. The leading treatise on this subject in Strong's day, Arthur Mellon Wellington's The Economic Theory of the Location of Railways, strongly advised against building any line that didn't lead to or from a well-populated city. By well-populated, Wellington meant a New York or Boston, and certainly not Pueblo. Moreover, the Santa Fe did not have Colorado all to itself. A rival company, the Denver and Rio Grande, had started in Denver back in 1872 with the idea of following the Rio Grande River to reach the Pacific in Mexico. It was presided over by a dashing Civil War hero, the Union General William J. Palmer. Over the next decade, Strong and Palmer engaged in a heady game of spy versus spy, tracking each other's movements, intercepting telegrams and decoding messages, and at one point, even disguising a surveyor as a Mexican shepherd, complete with sheep, to make topographical measurements in secret. Each sought to claim not just Colorado, but the entire Southwest out to California, as well as Mexico. In the course of their competition, they came into direct conflict on a variety of places. In the Royal Gorge outside of Pueblo, they fought perhaps the biggest railroad war in U.S. history, as each man sought exclusive access to one of the richest silver mines in the West at Leadville. Each side raised an army of ragtag soldiers to scare the other one off, and nearly as many lawyers. The war ran 2 years and didn't end until Jay Gould, the godlike robber baron who dominated the railroad industry, personally pressed for a treaty that would grant Leadville to the Rio Grande and the open territory to the south to the Santa Fe. With each side bleeding money and both threatened by Gould's ability to drive them out of business, they agreed. That looked like a bitter defeat for the Santa Fe until the Rio Grande silver was soon exhausted, while the land of the Southwest increased in value once it was reached by rail. At the same time, Strong was building west from Kansas. He was also building east, reaching Chicago in 1886, making it the westward gateway to the destinations the Santa Fe was adding. The most desirable of these was Los Angeles, which the Santa Fe reached in 1887. As it happened, another line was already in Los Angeles by then, the Southern Pacific, an outgrowth of the earlier Central Pacific, which ran its own line to Chicago through the hub in San Francisco. The Santa Fe's arrival sparked a frenzied rate competition with the Southern Pacific, each side trying to undercut the other, that ultimately dropped the price of a $125 ticket from Chicago to Los Angeles down to a single solitary dollar. Passengers flooded to Los Angeles, boosting the population of the once sleepy town from roughly 11,000 in 1880 to at least 50,000 by 1890. The speed of this growth set a Los Angeles record that has never been equaled. And dozens of other nearby cities, such as Pasadena, San Bernardino, and Riverside, shot up with it. A brand new word appeared to capture the real estate explosion. Boom, usually with exclamation mark attached. The Santa Fe's arrival created Southern California as a coveted destination for Easterners and Midwesterners and marked the culmination of the famous injunction to go west. Fevered promoters marketed Greater Los Angeles as paradise, and it pretty much was, a place of eternal sunshine, studded with exotic palm trees and bright with roses year-round. It was an Eden from which navel oranges could be shipped in the Santa Fe's ventilated or refrigerated boxcars to delight Americans everywhere. The Santa Fe made Southern California, said Richard White, a railroad historian, and Southern California made the Santa Fe. The railroad's success had other consequences. It helped to double Chicago's population in the 1880s, making it the nation's lumberyard and stockyard in the process. Chicago's central location inspired a sales innovation, the Montgomery Ward & Company mail order catalog, founded in 1872, which delivered by train goods from anywhere directly to customers everywhere, skipping retail stores and allowing Americans to get in on the latest big city fashions. After the Santa Fe arrived in Chicago, the catalog fattened up to more than 240 pages, offering an astounding 10,000 items. It's kind of an early predecessor to Amazon, right? With the line at full steam between two burgeoning cities, the Santa Fe gave rise to another innovation that would become a fixture of the American landscape, the chain restaurant. In partnership with New York restaurateur Fred Harvey, high-end Harvey House eateries appeared every 100 miles wherever the Santa Fe ran, serving a million meals a month early in the next century. The Santa Fe played a seminal role in the success of the movie business, itself a force that shaped the national character. After a New Jersey filmmaker, David Horsley, arrived in Hollywood to make westerns in the year-round sunshine early in the new century, D.W. Griffith and Cecil B. DeMille followed, making Los Angeles the dream factory for the nation. As for Strong himself, the real dream maker, he was forced to resign from the Santa Fe in 1889. His ambitious track laying had outpassed the company's revenues. Although raised in the Midwest, Strong retired in Los Angeles, settling in a modest bungalow. In declining health, he died there on August 3, 1914, at age 77. His obituary in the Los Angeles Times mentioned little about Strong's railroad career, noting instead that he had a forceful handshake that suggested a gratuitous humanity. That's kind of a strange epitaph. And there were also, as part of the rise of the railroad, this tiny article called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels by Teddy Brokaw. And the first is the Great Roundout Train Robbery in 1924, which took $3 million in jewelry cash bonds, which in today's money would have been more than $46 million. And that was in June of 1924. The elaborate plan involved a corrupt postal inspector, homemade tear gas, disguises, and 4 stolen Cadillacs. But the scheme unraveled. One outlaw shot another, making it possible for the police to track them down. And then there was the Hudson River Railroad robbery in 1869. That was with the help of a guard. This was between Buffalo and New York City. The other was in Rondout, the first one in Rondout, Illinois. But in Buffalo, with the help of a guard and the crooks had bribed, the duo of robbers hid in a baggage car en route to Grand Central Station, stole from the safe, leaped from train, and escaped into the Bronx. And their take was almost $2 million in today's dollars. And then in Boston, from between Boston and Michigan, the Mineral Range Railroad robbery in 1893. The men jumped aboard, broke into the baggage car, and grabbed the payroll for a local mining company. Famed Detective William Pinkerton tracked down the thieves. One clue was an odd shoe on a horse that pulled the getaway wagon, and he recovered all but $65. And the money that they took was a little over $2 million in today's money. And then in Roseville, California, Roy Gardner's Roseville robbery in 1921. Months earlier, Gardner was being taken to prison aboard a train in Oregon when he distracted the marshals guarding him, took a gun, cuffed them both, and fled to Canada. His robbery of a Southern Pacific train in California landed him at Alcatraz. And finally, the Reno gang's Adams Express robbery in 1868. Location was Marshfield, Indiana. Said the nation's first train robbers made their biggest heist after killing a crewman and breaking open 3 safes. Pinkerton detectives soon caught up with him, however, ending the notorious gang's 2-year reign of terror. I have a son who lives in Grapevine, up just in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and they have an old steam train that runs from Grapevine over to the Fort Worth stockyards. And at some times during the summer, because there are a lot of tourists that take it back and forth, they have a robbery. They arrive on horseback, and they pop onto the train with their bandanas covering their faces, and they don't take money from the visitors, actually. They hand them out. They hand out little coins as a joke. But it's kind of a fun way and a fun experience for a lot of kids who don't know anything about trains or about the way they are run anymore. So that's an interesting story about the history of train building. The Santa Fe, of course, still comes through San Antonio, I believe, and heads west. I think you can also take it north, too. It is a little bit longer than a lot of other methods of traveling today, however, so it's not always as... But it would be fun to try sometime. Well, thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.